Living quarters were compartments for single persons or married couples, for the crew was made up of both sexes, and these units comprised a small hallway, a large living room, bedroom, bathroom with toilet and storage locker. All rooms were carpeted with some form of pliant plastic and the walls were hung with beautiful paintings. I discovered the outer wall of the living room was in fact see-through, giving a full view of space outside. The outer door of each compartment led out onto a small flower-bedded garden. At this point, I commented on the lack of a kitchen in these units and was informed that Venusians never spoil their food by cooking it. They grew their own produce aboard and ate it fresh. We then came to the recreation area, which was covered with some form of simulated grass on which a number of the crew were playing a game somewhat like basketball. This gave me an opportunity to study these Venusians more closely, and I noted that they ranged from 5'6" to 6 feet in height. They were blue-eyed, skin coloring a bronze suntan, and their hair ranged from golden blonde to a reddish brown. They all appeared in glowing health and their eyes sparkled with a natural joie de vivre. Climbing to the third level, I found this was the horticultural section where all their food produce was grown, and there were attractive gardens where the crew relaxed and ate their food. The fourth level was divided between storage of more of the small scout ships, heavy material, water supply, etc., and a number of workshops. I had noted that throughout the entire ship all floors were completely covered with some form of plastic material and that all the cuter walls were of the same see-through type. On each wall, there was a circular viewing screen, somewhat like television, showing a full view of outer space and the exact position of the X-12 in relation to other planets, and its directional trajectory in space. This changing picture being projected from the control tower to all parts of the ship. I was also informed that built into these walls were accumulators for storing solar energy, which gave constant light and power to operate heating and air conditioning systems. Chapter 1 Part 2. We then rose to the exposed top of the tubular shaft, which I was told was the control room. My earthly mind had conjured up visions of all kinds of complex devices to operate this enormous spacecraft, but to my great surprise, there were no visible controls or equipment at all. In the center of the room was a raised circular platform on which had been built a circular couch, and seated with their backs to this and facing outward to the north, south, east and west, were four persons, two women and two men. I was informed that these four operators, chosen specially for their great mental powers, control-led and directed this giant ship. It all seemed completely unbelievable until across my doubting mind the flashed the biblical verse, "Faith can move mountains." My leader, companion then took me to a lower level and introduced me to a lovely woman whom he described as his life companion. She was indeed a most beautiful creature, with sapphire, blue eyes, golden, blonde hair, and her face glowed with an inner spirituality delightful to behold. He stood beside her and said simply, "You may call us Frank and Francis, for we stand for truth." I noticed that the girl was seated before a large blank screen, and a further wonder was in store for me, as she demonstrated her ability to project onto it thought forms of whatever she was thinking, which appeared on the screen as living motion pictures. To my surprise, she showed me a picture of myself coming out of Try House, followed by the scene in my workshop when I spoke with the two space visitors. There followed pictures of Venus, its people, homes and towns, and I just stood there overawed at its natural beauty. And then a strange phenomenon took place, which I know will sound as incredible as it did to me at the time, although there is much we do not know about the power of mind over matter. For while I was fully aware that I, Arthur Matthews, was standing in the physical form in a landed spaceship at Lackport, yet at the same time I suddenly became a living part of the projected scenes, mingling with the people of Venus millions of miles away. Here was a great mystery indeed, for I could not only see them but feel them just as if I was truly there in body as well as spirit. I appeared to be standing at the edge of a vast cup-like depression. On every side towered tall pillars of basalt, smooth and perfect as if polished by the hand of man. On the farther side of this huge natural theater, a mighty torrent of water descended from the brow of the ebony cliffs in a 1,000-foot leap, striking squarely on the edge of the great cup and turning it into a churning mass of foam. Then I saw it was only around the rocky margins of the pool that the water was beaten into foam. The entire center was occupied by a mass of water perfectly smooth and strangely piled up like a dome of glass. It was not water such as we know, for streamers of living light of every imaginable color darted over the shining surface of the great dome, sometimes blending into masses of rose or green or violet and then mingling into a glittering confusion of rainbow hues. This whole scene of overwhelming grandeur was foiled by a broad band of emerald green turf, which framed the central cup, and dotted here and there were graceful palm trees whose fronds glistened with diamond drops of spray. Then gazing upward, I gasped in surprise for there, poised in the air above the rim of the waterfall, was a great crystal ball like a gigantic soap bubble, transparent but gleaming with rainbow hues. Around its center was a broad band of gold metal. This girdle formed the equator and at either pole was a projecting boss of the same metal from which were suspended, by cables, inverted cups which hung some distance below the globe. As it drew nearer, I saw that the equatorial band was studded at intervals with circular windows of glass, like material from the center of each projected a long needle which I assured was for directing the course of the airship, a theory which later I found to be correct. Slowly the great ball sank until the cups touched the grass and the cables were withdrawn into the metal bosses. Here, the shining sphere hung about a foot above the ground, swaying gently. A moment later, a circular window swung open and several figures stepped out. Then the scene changed and I beheld a rolling, park-like country clustered with groups of palms and other trees. In the distance, I could discern the wall of black cliffs and beyond them rose range upon range of snow-capped peaks from which a wide river wound its way. In the central plateau about 50 miles in diameter, the river broadened into a shining lake and then continued its way until it plunged over the cliffs into the pit of the shining pool. Returning my gaze to the immediate scene around me, I realized I was in the center of a beautiful Venusian town. Innumerable buildings were spaciously scattered among groves of trees. While of varied size, these structures were of the same general design, consisting of an ellipsoidal roof of prismatic crystal supported on a circular colonnade of marble pillars. Above them, hundreds of balloon-like airships started through the air. Many of the houses were built on top of the basalt columns bordering the river and I could see groups of people standing on the verge of the cliffs. I then observed, standing on an elevation, a very large building of the same circular design which I was told was the community meeting place of these Venusians. Chapter 1 Part 2. I then found myself walking with the crew of the X-12, through a broad avenue of stately palms toward the white pillars of the great assembly hall. Soon we were climbing a noble stairway flanked by mighty columns until we stood in the center of a splendid amphitheater surrounded by tiers of marble seats in which a large group of people reclined. As we entered, they all arose, their hands raised in the Venusian salute and I heard a unanimous cry of brothers, goodwill unto you. It was then that I realized that these Venusians wore no garments but stood as nature created them, but such was their noble build. I could feel no embarrassment, only admiration of their physical beauty. I was led by Frank to a seat at one side of the huge auditorium and he then addressed me, friend from across space, Earthman Arthur Matthews, we welcome you. The people of Venus ask me to speak for them because I can talk your language freely. We have brought you here out of no idle curiosity, but because we believe it lies in our power to offer your world some help in its present troubled state. We have a priceless gift to offer you which is known to us as truth, but first we would ask you to tell us more of the world in which you live. Tell us something of its history, social conditions, science and what you call religion, and we will then judge if we are right in revealing to you the secret of truth. Speak in your own tongue, for all will understand your thoughts. Fear only to say that which is not true, for we shall know immediately the true from the false. Somewhat bewildered, I arose and after a pause, I spoke, "People of Venus, I thank you for your kind welcome and your offer. I do not know what this gift of truth may be, but if all the radiant health, happiness and beauty I see among you are due to this truth, I greatly desire to know its secret and share it with the people of Earth. But before I tell you something of conditions on my planet, may I first ask a question?" There were nods of approval and I continued, "Why have you chosen me to speak for Earth instead of going to the leaders of my world? I am a humble person whose name is unknown and I have no power with which to convince few, if any, on Earth." "We understand your question," Frank replied. "We have chosen you because, as a friend of Tesla, we believe you will tell us the truth. As for your humble origin, did not the Supreme Creator in whom we of Venus all believe, your God, chose one of lowly birth to spread the truth of your Christian philosophy? In your Bible, you will read, 'In the beginning there was the Word or the truth as we call it, and of God's desire that his children 85, should believe, in the Word.' If we decide to pass on this truth to you, then God will surely see that channels are opened up to you to pass on his Word." In deep humility, I replied, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I thank you." And then, to the best of my ability, I proceeded to tell the Venusians what I knew of Earth's history. I described the development of war from the days of the cross, bow and sword to its present stage of destructive sophistication. I dealt with what ancient history I knew and briefly brought it up to modern times. I talked on present-day social conditions, our technological achievements, a little on medicine, psychology, philosophy, and comparative religion, and then I turned to science. Up to this point, these godlike Venusians had listened to my poor talk with absorbed attention, but as I attempted to explain Earth's concept of physics, there was a great commotion as members of the assembly leapt to their feet and I heard repeated cries clamoring for the truth. I could only conclude from this that our scientists' present knowledge of physics left much to be desired. A few words from Frank, explaining that I was telling the truth only as I knew it, quieted the group and he apologized to me for the interruption. At the conclusion of my talk, I was invited by Frank and his beautiful companion, Francis, to spend some time with them, and, to my great delight, they took me for a flight in their small airship where I sat back entranced at the glorious landscape unfolding beneath us. And then, as mysteriously as I had been teleported to Venus by the thought projection process, I suddenly found myself back in the landed spaceship Atlakport, facing an empty screen. Over the years of continued landings of the X-12 Atlakport, I was able, by means of Francis' strange ability to project me into her living pictures, to continue my contacts with the Venusians, whom I grew to love for their gentle, courteous ways, their radiant happiness and beauty of mind and body. Always, Frank and Francis acted as my host and hostess and I spent many happy hours with this gracious couple, sometimes wandering on pleasant walks through groves of cinnamon and nutmeg trees, breathing in the soft, perfumed air, sometimes going on fabulous flights of exploration in their airship, and at other times, we relaxed in their beautiful crystal dwelling, discussing many matters, exchanging information on our respective planets, and all the time, I learn more of the harmonious way of life of these happy Venusians. Frank talked freely on all aspects of the life of his people, with one exception, the nature and meaning of the truth, from which I gathered that the time was not yet right for this revelation. I was amazed at the perfection of the Venusian mode of one planetary government guided by a small council of wise leaders and also at the extreme simplicity of the social relationships of its people who appeared to be one large family bound together by love and understanding. At one time I asked Frank if Francis was his wife. "No, not in the sense your world interprets this word," he replied. "We have mutually elected to become life companions." "Then surely you have been united by some ceremony such as we call marriage?" "No, with this mutual desire in our hearts, we have no need for meaningless words. So there is nothing to prevent you from separating at any time?" "Nothing at all." Then what we call divorce must be common on Venus, I ventured. The Venusian couple laughed outright. As common as the rose voluntarily cuts itself from the bush, remarked Francis with a gentle laugh. Let me explain, said Frank. When Venusian couples unite, because of their knowledge of the truth, it is impossible for them to make a mistake, for they recognize each other as soul, mates, and the union is forever. It is sad that your world lacks this knowledge, for it would appear that such legal ceremonies are necessary because your people are insecure and uncertain of each other. During one of our aerial excursions over the wooded countryside, I remarked on the absence of any burial grounds and that the word death had never been mentioned in our talks. Frank countered with, How old are you, Arthur?
48 years.
What is the normal life span on Earth?
70, 100 years.
Then you will probably be surprised to learn I have seen over 800 summers and Francis over 650. You must be joking, I exclaimed. Sickness and old age sap the vitality of the body and within 100 years, it dies. Frank shook his head, because we apply the knowledge of the truth, we know nothing of sickness or old age, true, we finally leave our bodies, not because they are worn out but because our appointed tire has come to transfer to another sphere of existence. But a few of us with special missions here, such as those with the required wisdom to govern our planet, may live on in perfect health for thousands of years. I was left dumbfounded at these remarks, which seemed more than my earthly mind could absorb. And thus the periodic contacts with the Venusians continued, with information exchange and progress reports on my work on the Tesla devices passing between us, until finally the great day arrived when Frank informed me that the Venusian assembly had decided that the gift of truth should be extended to me and through me, to the people of Earth. You may well imagine my excitement on learning that this great mystery was at last to be revealed to me. It was to take place, Frank said, at the Venusian's most sacred shrine, the Palace of Truth, and although he spoke of its great beauty, I was little prepared for the further wonders in store for a bewildered earthling. First, I was taken to the edge of the cliffs where the river gathered for its final plunge, and Frank led the way to a flight of spiraling steps carved out of the solid rock. We descended these steps, which eventually entered the rock itself, and we came out onto a small platform directly under the mighty waterfall which thundered down to the abyss. With a thrill of horror, I realized we were standing on top of one of the towering basalt columns, and I admit I shook with fear. But Frank grasped my hand and led me to a further flight of spiraling steps. Down we went, sometimes passing close to the water whose roar grew louder as we descended, and sometimes passing through tunnels in the rock. Behind us there followed a seemingly endless line of figures. Finally, we came to a great cave directly under the fall, and the living rock trembled with the force of its tremendous impact. On we went until we passed through an arched opening and stood at last in the Palace of Truth. At the glory of the sight that met my eyes, I let out an involuntary cry of delight and amazement. We stood on the broad shelf of black basalt surrounding a great circular depression about 1,000 feet in diameter, which was filled with a mass of colored water which surged and rippled like a sea of rainbows. A closer inspection revealed that it was in fact a floor of living crystal. See Chap. 4, Revelations, and looking up, I saw it was reflecting the underside of the great dome of water in the center of the pool below the waterfall. By some strange magic beyond my comprehension, the crystal lake held this mass of churning, multicolored water suspended in mid-air, its under surface reflecting a thousandfold. It was the most breathtakingly beautiful sight I had ever seen. While I had been absorbing the indescribable beauty of this natural kaleidoscope, the basalt shelf had been filling with the great company of people assembled for this meeting. Then Frank raised his hand in salute and spoke. Friend from Earth, the glory you behold is our Palace of Truth, and we have brought you here as a fitting place to reveal to you its secret. You have told us truly of the world in which you live, and we are grieved at your story. Therefore, we hope this revelation in time will lead to a great improvement in conditions on your planet. Make no mistake, we do not worship the truth. We worship the one God whom no man may know. As for the truth, We know not from whence it comes, only that it fills all space and permeates all things. It is no great mystery confined to our planet alone, it is free for all to seek and use throughout the universe. You yourself have revealed that you have known the truth for many years, but you have not recognized it as such. Did not you tell us that your friend, Tesla, had discovered and used the cosmic ray? This, my friend, is the truth, which we also call the power of life. It is the essence which animates all living things, man, animal, vegetable and mineral. It is the vibration which responds to the mind and spirit of all life, and once one has learned to use this great natural law wisely, one mind beholds another in all its truth, so that misunderstanding is impossible. Thus, it is we are able to understand you when you speak your own language, for we see not only the outer shell as you do, but the living mind within that shell. It is because of our understanding of the truth that we enjoy long life in perfect health, happiness and harmony, that we are able to construct and operate by pure thought our spacecraft and other technological wonders you have seen, erect beautiful dwellings with every comfort and convenience, transmute our planet into beauty and agricultural productivity, effect climate control and avert natural disasters. In short, we have transformed our planet into a paradise. And all these things, my friend, may be achieved by the people of Earth if they learn to recognize and use the truth. I had listened in some surprise to learn that the truth should be none other than the cosmic ray, which I knew something about, for Tesla had built his scope and other wonderful inventions to utilize the power of this ray. I knew too, that more than a purely physical force was involved, because in harnessing the cosmic ray, Tesla had discovered that it responded to mental vibrations. But one big question burned in my mind and I asked Frank, but how can the people of Earth recognize this truth? We do not see the truth with the physical eye, he replied. We see it with an inner eye that lies in the metaphysical area of the mind and which is opened up by spiritual development. You seem to forget, I returned, that most of us on Earth lack this special sixth sense which enables Venusians to visualize mental images produced by the truth. You can tell a blind man of the light, but you cannot make him see. Ather, this special faculty is not the exclusive possession of Venusians. It is common to all mankind, inherent in life itself. For countless generations, your race has lived and died like men who bandage their eyes that they might not see the light. Listen carefully. And then in words so simple that the humblest person could understand, Frank revealed the secret whereby people of Earth, if they choose to accept it, can learn to develop this marvelous sixth sense and the full consciousness of truth. In essence, it was nothing more or less than to carry out the philosophy of love of God and all his creatures, as taught by Jesus Christ, which in turn, would open up that special spiritual area of the mind to see the truth. Then, in ringing tones that sounded like the clear notes of a bugle, Frank addressed Tyre, go back to your Earth, Ather, and tell its people of the things you have seen and the knowledge you have acquired. But Frank, I cried in an anguished voice, although I shall speak the truth, few will believe me. Most will dismiss my words as, at best, a utopian fantasy. Many will label me crackpot or worse. Frank grasped my shoulders and spoke firmly. Heed not the words of the foolish. Speak for those with sufficient wisdom to learn. If you only reach a few, your efforts and all the ridicule will not have been in vain. Go forth with the word, Ather, and God go with you. With these words still ringing in my ears, I found myself back in full consciousness on the landed X-12. As I prepared to depart, the beautiful woman of countless years rose from her blank screen and with a lovely smile, extended her hand in farewell. Later, from a distance, I watched the great ship rise silently and swiftly and take off into that summer's night of 1961. Chapter 2. It was during the fall of 1942 that the X-12 paid me another short visit. Frank wished to talk to me about a very private matter. During this visit I was lucky to be able to take a good look at the X-12 inside and out. Frank came into my home and after we finished our private talk, we walked down to the landing spot,
When we reached the ship, I stood wild-eyed looking at that great and wonderful thing. Other members of the crew came out, all of them laughing at the surprised look on my face. But what I saw of the outside of that great ship was nothing to the wonders which I was to see and hear inside. It was in fact the thought, pictures, which first convinced me that this ship and its crew of 24 persons was indeed, as they said, from the planet Venus. When Frank and I arrived at the ship, he said, "Come inside and you may, if you wish, take a good look all over." I accepted his invitation, and he led me to a door, and we stepped into a small room, which he said was the elevator. In a few seconds, we arrived at the top level, or control room, located at the top of the elevator shaft, about 300 feet high. "This is our control room," said Frank. "You may inspect it." "But," I replied, "where are the controls?" All I saw in the room was a circular seat, on which sat four persons, two women and two men. These four took no notice of us. They just sat and looked, so it appeared, directly at the wall. "These four are our controls," said Frank. "But where are the meters?" I asked, "and other things which appear to be an important part of our aircraft? In what manner can you guide, steer and control the power of this large ship without some form of control?" "Well," said Frank, "perhaps the manner in which we control this ship, that is to say, the means we use, may appear to you Earth people an impossibility. Every member of our crew is trained in the practical use of thought power. The four members whom you see here, keep the ship under perfect control at all times by the simple application of pure thought. In order to convince you, or at least try to convince you, that this ship has no other power, you may inspect every inch of it. But I can assure you there is no engine of any kind, either inside or outside. But, measure carefully. Convince yourself. If you study the question, you will find nothing remarkable about our ability to make a practical use of the power of applied thought. Every person on Earth could, with advantage, do the same. Millions of you Earth people buy the Bible, but how many make a practical use of it? Christ walked on the water by means of thought power or faith, and did he not say, "The works which I do, you can do, and even greater works than these, because I go to my Father"? Do you not see the wonders you Earth people could do if you believed in what Christ said? We of Venus do not consider ourselves any smarter than people of Earth. The difference appears to be in the fact that we take it for granted that Christ knew what he was talking about. We believe in what he said, with the results which you see in our ship, and the way in which we live on Venus. With those remarks, Frank said, "Make a good inspection. I will wait outside for you, and when you are finished looking for our mystery engine, Francis will continue with her picture show," and left me. I then had a very careful look around the control room but could find no sign of a motor or material control of any sort. I then walked down some steps to the fourth level, which was divided between storage of small scout ships, heavy material, water supply, etc., with a number of workshops, but I could find nothing like a power plant. The third level was very much the same, except it had a large horticultural section where all their food was grown, and the lovely gardens where the crew relaxed and ate their food. A few scout ships were also on this floor. I had a good look all over and then continued going down to the second level. So far no sign of a power plant. I found the second level the same as the others, except a part comprised the living quarters of the crew. It had flower gardens, a recreation area, study rooms and a meeting hall. Living quarters were compartments for single persons or married couples, each unit comprised of a small hallway, a large living room, bedroom, bathroom with a flush toilet and storage locker. But still no sign of a power plant or any material controls. After a good look, I walked down to the first level, which was devoted to the storage of some more small spacecraft and ground vehicles, workshops and other equipment. "Well," I thought, "if there is any motor on this ship, it must be made of invisible and sizeless material, for there was not an inch of space anywhere on that ship which I had not inspected. To be sure,
I would have to take a good look on the outside of the ship. During my inspection trip, I noted with delight the beautiful floor covering, of many colors, which appeared to be made of a synthetic material, very soft to walk on. The walls were hung with beautiful paintings, none of which were of the modern kind, and each living room had a see-through window giving a full view of the outside.